Today on Maine Calling, the Allegash Wilderness Waterway, an encore presentation. The Allegash has a legendary, almost mythic reputation. There is nothing like it. The Allegash Wilderness Waterway is a 92-mile protected corridor, which includes the Allegash River, of course, and many lakes and streams. Many people dream of someday canoeing the Allegash, a real wilderness adventure. For millennia, Wabanaki people traveled and traded on the Allegash. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we listen back to our earlier program about the Allegash and its important ecology. For the first time in more than 50 years, biologists and ecologists have completed an extensive survey of its flora and fauna. We'll discuss its trees, flowers, mussels, and fish, and we'll learn about efforts to introduce the magic of this place to young people. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The Allegash Wilderness Waterway is treasured by paddlers, anglers, wildlife enthusiasts, and more. A new ecological survey underscores just how extraordinary the region is. Joining me to discuss the Allegash Wilderness Waterway today, Janet McMahon, who is an ecologist and author of A River in Space and Time. Daniel Dinsmore, who is Executive Director of the Allegash Wilderness Waterway Foundation and former editor and publisher of the Maine Monitor, and Paul Johnson, fisheries biologist who has spent decades on the Allegash Wilderness Waterway. Dan, I understand next year marks the 60th anniversary of the creation of the Allegash Wilderness Waterway that happened in 1966. For those who are new to Maine or some of the young people in our audience, tell us what makes it so unusual.
Well, the Allegash is truly a wonder. I mean, it's just an amazing wonder. It spans 1.1 million acres. It's considered one of the most pristine river ecosystems in the United States. It's a 92-mile corridor of lakes, rivers, and streams bordered by an extensive northern forest. Historically, it has served as the travel route for the Wabanaki and later was used by explorers, loggers, and outdoor recreationists. And in 1966, it was designated by the state legislature as a protected ecological and value and natural character. And so AWWF exists to make sure that we continue to protect and enhance the natural characteristics of the Allegash. It is an incredible place, and we hope that this new book will help people appreciate the Allegash more.
You mentioned a little bit of its history. One important time in its history was the 1840s, right? I mean, part of the Allegash changed directions. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, Janet, you want to talk about the 1840s?
Sure. At that time, logging was getting pretty competitive, and a group of people wanted logs to flow to Bangor instead of to the St. John's. So they put in some dams and diverted the flow from the bottom three lakes, Allegash Lake, Chamberlain, and Telos, into the east branch of the Penobscot. So the bottom portion of the river flows mostly or into the east branch, although most of it flows into the St. John.
Okay. And Janet, I was going to turn to you next anyway. You recently led the ecological assessment of the Allegash Wilderness Waterway and resulting in this wonderful book. And this was the first time, I understand, since its creation in 1966 that there was a large scale, intensive ecological assessment. Why was it so important to do this now? And did you find significant changes?
We learned an incredible amount, and I will say it, even though it resulted in a 200-page report, it's still the tip of the iceberg. But there had been recommendations to do one for probably 20 years, and I don't know, you know, just bureaucracy, whatever, kept it from happening. So we discovered a lot. You know, one of the big picture things was, even though I paddled the river many times with my family before doing this work, until I slowed down and also thought about the context, we didn't realize how unique it was east of the Rockies. And it's has no towns, no public roads, no farms, no residential development, no mines, no energy infrastructure, no utilities. And it's unique that way. There are no other rivers in Maine. You know, even the St. John has tributaries coming in from farmland in Quebec. So because of that, it felt more intact. I've worked on a number of watersheds in the state than anywhere I've been, in terms of the ecological integrity of the place, the water quality, the amazing variety of wetland types, all kinds of things.
And Paul, of course, what is that water quality? What does that unique nature of the Allagash Waterway mean for the fish? What do we find there?
The Allagash Waterway has been known for years, even well before the waterway was established, for its brook trout populations. We've learned recently that in recent years that Maine holds the majority of wild native brook trout in the country in the eastern range of the species. And wild native brook trout are found throughout the waterway, in the river, in its tributary streams, and in the 100 so ponds that contribute. Brook trout are an amazing species. They're diverse in the waterway. There are river populations, there are the brook populations, the ponds, and even the lake populations. They all have different life histories. Although they're all brook trout, they all have different life histories. And the nice thing about the Allagash is, above the falls, there have been no introductions of non-native species that would compromise any of those fisheries. And above the falls, the waters are connected, so the species can interact. Stream fish can go to the river, pond fish can move into streams and back and forth. And all of this is very important to the ecology, the importance of the waterway. And we talk about the watershed, but the waterway is really important.
So above the falls, what we find for fish are what we might have found hundreds of years ago.
Very much so. Since the glacier receded, 12,000 years ago.
Paul, tell us what the survey found out, though, about the brook trout. It's a little concerning, right?
Well, my part in the survey was to provide Janet with the information on all the waters and what was available in them. We didn't do any work as such on the fish species, but we relied on the work that's been done by IF&W for surveys throughout the waterway. What we did find in our research is that the Allagash River had a temperature monitor by USGS back in the 70s, and then again in 2010 to 2015. And it showed an increase in the water temperature during the summer months. It's not surprising that the water temperature in the Allagash River was warm to begin with. Back in 1960, Ken Warner, the fishery biologist, reported that the river itself gets warm, don't need the tributaries. So when we saw that increase, however, with all the talk about the warming climate, the Allagash Wilderness Waterway Foundation decided a temperature monitoring project would be appropriate to locate the tributaries that are most important, the cool water tributaries. So since 2022, we've monitored 21 different streams for temperatures, and found that a lot of the streams are providing the cold water they need, but there's more to be done.
Janet.
One of the things that surprised me, the first year I was up there, it was very dry and warm. And so I was spending a lot of time barefoot walking the shorelines, and I noticed wherever cold water was coming into the lakes and the larger tributaries. And it was coming out mostly out of cedar swamps and wetlands and other types of wetlands. But one thing I didn't realize was so important were those forested wetlands, which we don't usually talk about much. They don't have any protections, but they're hugely important to keeping some of these streams cool. And they'd always be, I wouldn't have to look on a map for them. I would just feel the cold temperatures when I was walking ashore underfoot. It was the best way to find them. So that connection, the stream temperature monitoring and what's going on with the forests around them is one of the reasons that this is happening.
Mm. Janet, I'm flipping through the book. I'm discovering some things I didn't know, of course, about the Allagash. Tell us about some of the more unusual or just special things to be found there. I'm thinking about the bladderwort.
Well, honestly, wherever I go, I'm kind of in awe. But the bladderwort is a little tiny plant, about maybe 6 inches tall, with yellow flowers, and it's ubiquitous. There's thousands of them, but you probably don't really see them. They can either be in mud or they can be in marshes. And they don't have any roots. They just hold themselves up by their stem. And on the stems are these bladders that actually can suck in insects. They feed on insects or you know, phytoplankton and that kind of thing. And it comes in really fast. And they also have bacteria in those teeny little bladders, which are about, oh, I don't know, a 16th of an inch across. They have algae that attracts the insects into the bladder, and they suck them in, you know, in a millisecond. So they're these little carnivorous plants by the thousands all over the waterway. They're very cool. And the other thing I'll just mention, because Paul's here, and one of my favorite fish, I love brook trout, but it's fall fish, which is a minnow that a lot of people call chub. There's three different species in the waterway. And on the dry year, there'd be these mounds of rocks that were like 2 feet high, little stones, maybe 1 to 2 inches across. And they could be half as wide as my canoe. And there's hundreds of them, usually where tributaries come into the waterway. And that's where fall fish lay their eggs, into that rock pile, so it's protected. So I'm intrigued by them. People don't like to eat them. I still never have, and I really want to try one, but call them rock stars. They're truly amazing.
I'm looking at the picture in the book of the rock piles. Paul, the fish don't build the rock piles, do they?
Rock by rock. Male tall fish will build them rock by rock.
Really?
In its mouth. Females will lay eggs in that.
How do they do that? Do they do it when the water's higher than...
They're spring spawners. So in the spring, okay, the water runoff is fairly high. They'll build these nests underwater. Females will lay their eggs. Because the water is warming, the eggs hatch fairly quickly. So as the water recedes, the young kind of distribute. We always, as a fishery biologist, we always looked at fall fish as competitors. But in doing this work and working with Janet, I began to realize there's a whole lot more to these things than just what they provide to humans. It's what they provide to each other. And these fall fish nests provide habitat for other fish to lay eggs. And the fall fish themselves contribute to the ecosystem. They're a source of food for eagles, osprey, otters, mink. So it's
Yeah, Paul, I'm going to describe it. I'm looking at the photo that's in the book, and it does. It looks almost like a just a pile of rock that might have been dumped by a dump truck or something. And you're telling me that a little fish is building this. I can only imagine people trying to figure out what this is, to go to a place that they feel as though people hadn't been before, and to find these piles of rocks. It's really something.
That's neat. Most fall fish, they average probably 8 inches or less, but they can grow up to 12, 14 inches. So obviously the larger the fish, the bigger the mouth, the larger the rocks, and the larger the piles.
And that was obviously that was the low water year I was walking. So those would normally be underwater in the spring.
I see.
But if you're paddling along, you may see like all these little pyramids under you as you paddle.
Dan, I want to return to you. You know, you've recently become involved in the Allegash Wilderness Waterway. And I'm wondering, not as a scientist, but as a Mainer, what does it mean to you?
You know what? It means... it's just this special place that exists that very few people really know about and appreciate. And so as a Mainer, I feel very, very proud to be able to tell the story of the Allegash and be able to communicate the need to protect the Allegash and to work with such an incredible board of directors, Jennifer. As you can tell from Janet and Paul, we have a terrific board of directors who have spent their careers focused on ecology and biology and conservation. And these people know the Allegash and appreciate the Allegash at a level that I hope to get to someday. But the Allegash itself just represents this wilderness, this thought that Maine has this incredible nature to offer to people. And it's really important to make sure that we protect that that parcel of land. It's just incredible, and it's magical, and it's that tells a story as old as Maine. And so I think that it's just well worth protecting and well worth talking about.
We'll go to Chris, who's calling from East Machias. Hi, Chris, go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. My father was one who did not want me sitting around the house watching TV. So from 1962, when I was 9 years old, to 1968, when I was 15, I was sent to Wavis camps on Damariscotta Lake in Jefferson, which was overseen by Harold Westerman, the then University of Maryland football coach. Very strict camp. Thanks to that camp, I got up Mount Katahdin twice. And in 1968, my last year there, my cabin mates, myself, along with counselors, took a two-week trip down the Allegash River. And I think we did something different from the previous years. We actually went up, I think, Allegash Stream. We jumped out of our canoes and walked through the water up to this. I think there's a little lake or a pond at the head of it. And we did that, which is kind of different. And then we finished our trip on the river. But it was that was 57 years ago, and I'm very, very thankful that I did it.
Chris, thanks so much for calling Paul. You're nodding. You've done the same thing?
I managed Allegash Lake, spent nights there both summer and winter. It's right at the, it is at the headwater of the original Allegash watershed. It's now being managed as a wilderness lake. There are no vehicles or motorized equipment allowed within a mile of it for recreational purposes. It's as pristine in terms of species and water quality as any of the other lakes. And getting there is, like I said, it's very difficult. You can't fly in with a plane. So Allegash is my special place in the waterway, really.
Wonderful. Chris, I'm so glad you called and mentioned it. And Dan, you know, Chris was talking about doing this as a young person, and I know that there's a real effort underway right now to get more and more young people out on the waterway, including a couple trips every summer, right?
Yeah, so AWWF has been sponsoring trips on the Allegash for a decade now. And so we really want to focus on bringing youth to the Allegash. We believe that a healthy Allegash depends on young people experiencing the power of the waterway today. So what we're focused on doing is raising the next generation of stewards for the waterway. And introducing them to the incredible, wilderness that's in their backyard. So we want to focus, make sure that they understand that there are careers, there are guides, guiding careers, ranger careers. There are many different careers within the timber industry, ecology, biology sort of careers. And so working with the school districts in the Fort Kent area, we have now taken what we call the Youth on the Allegash program, or YODA as an acronym. And we're expanding that entire program to make sure that all eighth grade kids in the Fort Kent area have an opportunity to experience the Allegash starting in 2026. So it's a terrific accomplishment, so to speak, after a decade of making sure that we sponsor trips, now to actually bake the entire YODA program into the school district up there. It's really a great opportunity.
Wonderful.
To make sure these kids get to experience the Allegash.
You said every Fort Kent, did you say eighth grader?
Every eighth grade in the three districts that make up the St. John Valley. So Madawaska,
wow.
St. Agatha, Fort Kent, all of those kids starting in 2026 will have an opportunity to experience the Allegash.
Wonderful. Well, we do need to take a quick break. We're talking about the Allegash. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
And a note, this program is a rebroadcast of an earlier show. We are not taking any phone calls or responding to emails or social media posts.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking today about what ecologists are learning about the makeup of the Allegash Wilderness Waterway. My guest today, Daniel Dinsmore, who is a journalist and executive director of the Allegash Wilderness Waterway Foundation. Paul Johnson, a fisheries biologist who spent decades on the Allegash. And Janet McMahon, ecologist and author of the book, A River in Space and Time. Calling in now is Don Hudson, who is a naturalist and conservation leader, who is board president and founding member of the Allegash Wilderness Waterway Foundation. He is a co-author of This Extraordinary Place, A Guide to Allegash Ecology. Thanks so much for calling us, Don.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I know that you've been involved with conservation for so many years. Tell us what makes the Allegash so special to you.
Well, I think I first visited the Allegash in the late 60s. And as other people have mentioned, the place is magnetic. Once you've been there, you've got to return. And it may be 10 years or 20 years before you get another chance to go back, but it's always there in your memory. At least it has been in mine. So when the opportunity came for us to create a friends group to support the waterway, it was a no-brainer to get involved.
Don, you know, Dan mentioned the program to take young people on the Allegash, all the folks from the young people from the St. John Valley. I'm wondering, what are some of the other goals? What are some of the other ways in which you want to protect the waterway, and also, but at the same time, making sure people understand the place?
Well, the waterway has tried to keep our areas of focus a short list, limited, if you will, although in each of those areas, they could be easily expanded. Dan mentioned youth on the Allegash. We anticipate in the coming years that we might try to have a statewide program similar to that in Baxter State Park, the youth program for the Baxter State Park kids that draws students from around the state. We're hoping to emulate that. The area of focus that we refer to as natural resource inventory and monitoring is the program that essentially inspired Janet's work. And we anticipate in the coming years that we'll have some ongoing conversations with neighboring landowners. And to see what kinds of work we may be able to do together to help ensure that the Allegash is an ecologically healthy place for centuries to come. We're just beginning conversations with people who have been in the region for thousands of years, the Wabanaki people, the northern tribes in particular, exploring ways that we can support their re-engagement, if you will, with part of homeland that they have been, for all intents and purposes, excluded from for the past 200 years. So, we've got a sort of short list of efforts, but it's a full plate. It's a full plate.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. That's Don Hudson, a longtime conservationist and board president of the Allegash Wilderness Waterway Foundation. And on the line with us now is Alexandra Conover-Bennett, who is an author and registered Maine guide. Thanks so much for calling in, Alexandra.
Hey, you're welcome.
So I understand you were awarded the Fly Rod Crosby Lifetime Outdoor Achievement Award in the fall. Congratulations.
Yes, it was quite amazing. Thank you.
I'll ask you a similar question to one I asked Dan. What makes the Allegash so special to you?
You know, that question is something I think every guide has to really give some thought to eventually. And it hit Garrett, my lifelong partner in these kind of adventures, early on in our career, in our late 20s, because guests just seem to, on a five-day trip, by day 2.5, they were so-called in the groove. I mean, they were just happy kids. And we kept thinking, I mean, the tonic of nature, you know, there's all sorts of people, you know, we all write about it and try to think about it. Anyway, what we boiled down it to was, boy, you know, we're actually just living in present time. We're hungry. We're cold. The wind's rising. Oh, the wind's dying. We have to paddle at night. Oh, we get up early. The mist is rising. You're constantly adjusting to the environment around you. And we guided small groups of just 6 people with 2 guides. And you're adjusting to the group. Every week it's different. Sometimes we had personalities that were like tubas. We might have 3 tubas, 2 flutes, and 1 violin. How are we going to make this group sound good? And the Allegash allows tubas and violins. You know, my analogy here is humorous, but I really mean it. People learn to just get in the groove because present time demands it, and it makes you form a really fun group.
Well, let me ask you this. A lot of people may be listening to this program right now and thinking, boy, on one level, I would love to do this. I'd love to do a wilderness trip, a primitive wilderness trip at the Allagash, but I'm not sure I'm up for it. Who is up for it? Who can do this?
Well, I wouldn't say everybody's up for it, because you may have, if you're not very experienced, you might really have a miserable experience. It could be just black flies or rain that gets you, or it might be dumping your canoe. So I work with 19, 20, 21-year-olds at College of the Atlantic in the outdoors. And what I suggest to them, and really anybody, is, you know what, try stuff in your backyard, a small pond, camp on its shore overnight. Get used to your tent, being in the woods overnight. What are those weird sounds? Get all that under your belt before you just go to the grand one of them all. I mean, so-called Allagash. It is our most famous river. But it doesn't mean it's necessarily going to provide you with the best outdoor experience. So that's my short answer.
All right. And then I just wanted to ask you about this idea of, you said it's our most famous river, and people go because they want a true wilderness experience. Do you find that more and more people are seeking this out, that more people are contacting you, I don't know, post-pandemic than before?
Well, I do work with the college crew. I'm sort of out of the having to promote myself as a guide and attract clients. I don't really know those numbers. But I would say that people actually want easy access. And I don't mean to make this a negative thing, but it is in terms of wilderness. So I think what is positive is what the AWWF is doing. The foundation is raising awareness of what is wilderness, what is wildness. Why do we love Baxter Park? Why do we love the Allagash? The Saco is fun. That's a party river. It's noisy. There's roads, blah, blah. So I think I actually feel very positive about it, that if we can raise the understanding of the value of wildness and the fact that a river is just fine without us. As much as I love humans, rivers are their own ecosystem. They're their own home. They do fine. We just have to learn how to dance with them. These mixed metaphors, but that's how I think. If we learn how to dance with them, the rivers will thrive and people will.
Alexandra, thank you so much for calling in. That's Alexandra Conover-Bennett, an author and renowned Maine guide. Janet, one thing we haven't talked about yet, and we do have calls coming in, but I think this is really important to talk about, is when we're talking about preserving the Allagash, there is the reality of climate change. And I'm wondering what you foresee in the near term and longer term future for the river and for the whole corridor of river and lakes.
That's a big question, which I couldn't help think about. I mean, first of all, just remember, it's such a dynamic system, more than most, because the amount of snow and ice scour along the shore, and it's been changing constantly since the glaciers left. So, which is always heartening to me, and it was also bustling with logging activity, and you'd hardly know that now. But the future is sobering because, you know, the best case scenario is the climate up there will be like central Maine by the end of this century. The worst cases will be like York County. And that's a profound shift. Obviously, a lot of species are going to be moving in and others are going to be moving out. And a big one is water temperature, all those cold water fish and cold water aquatic species. But all the things we think of when we're there are noticed, like loons and moose and brook trout and a host of other things, are likely going to be moving north. So, but we do feel that because it is relatively intact compared to almost any other place in the East, we can make it as resilient as we can, you know, by having adequate stream buffers, protecting some of these wetland forests, you know, really thinking about how to care for the watershed as a whole, so that water's connected and as cold as possible. And maybe things will turn around, you know, politically and in terms of climate change trajectories. But I feel like that's really important. And there's also a very close interplay with forest management practices, which could be another conversation. So I won't start that one.
We'll go to Steve calling from Frenchville. Hi, Steve, go ahead.
How are you? People, thanks for taking my call. I'm Steve Young. I'm president of the Upper St. John River Organization. And I've worked personally as a wildlife biologist with the Partners Program for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service upriver. We're a land trust, and we own a couple of islands at the confluence of the Allagash and the St. John. And we promote standards for wildlife habitat and biodiversity assessments and management. And we added those to our bylaws. It includes use of something called the Northeast Terrestrial Wildlife Habitat Classification System, which is both a GIS-based system, and it has standards for naming convention and assessments of condition of habitat. Sue Gawler represented Maine in those efforts, and we've adopted that. And so I want to throw that out, that that's what we're promoting, along with Northern White Cedar, Arborvitae, Thuja occidentalis, which is our longest-lived tree, are most important for wintering deer and a lot of other species, strongly associated with our wetlands, grows very slowly, and there's no plan for its sustainability out in the landscape. So we have, as an organization, have moved over 100,000 seedlings in collaboration with the Aroostook County Conservation Association. And I just want to throw that out there, that the forest management part of it is a huge part. In the Furbish's louse work we have done for habitat, we have raised and planted silver maple along the floodplain. So that's it. Thank you very much.
Steve, thanks so much for calling in. Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. That's the forest management conversation. We're always, I think that Janet's work has allowed us to have more meaningful conversations with forest, with landowners. And the hope with this new book is that we're building the social will with a greater population to care about the Allagash. Steve, I will follow up with you after the call. Thank you for that. I think you and I should meet. I think the work that you're doing sounds terrific, and I look forward to following up. But Jennifer, I just think that the book that we produced, This Extraordinary Place, it speaks to the need for a larger group of people to be focused on the Allagash and the Northern Maine woods as a whole. It is truly an important, I mean, it's such an important part of Maine, but really a part of the entire country that we all need to protect.
All right, Steve, thank you so much for your call. And we are going to go to one more break. We're talking about the Allagash on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're talking about the Allagash Wilderness Waterway, now and in the future. Joining me, Paul Johnson, who is a fisheries biologist, Daniel Dinsmore with the Allagash Wilderness Waterway Foundation, and Janet McMahon, an ecologist and one of the authors of This Extraordinary Place. Joining us now is Mark DeRoach, who is superintendent of the Allagash Wilderness Waterway with the Bureau of Parks and Lands and a master Maine guide. Thanks so much for calling in, Mark.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me.
And I understand I most mispronounced your name. I see the note here, DeRoach, Mark DeRoach. Thank you so much, and I apologize. I understand you had a longtime dream of someday working on the Allagash. Tell us your story.
Yeah, well, it started when I was, I think, a freshman in high school. Back in 1980, I had an opportunity to go up and spend some time in a logging camp not too far from Churchill Lake, back before mechanized logging was a thing, when there were still crews with skidders. And I got a chance to go up and fish and hunt, and it was every young man and young lady's dream, I suppose. But I kept going, and I actually went to school at the University of Maine up at Fort Kent. And the real reason I went up there wasn't necessarily for an education. It was probably to be a little closer to the Allagash and be able to, again, be out there to fish and hunt and canoe and do the things I enjoyed. And I ended up getting out of school and going down a whole different path. I actually ended up working for a couple of social service agencies. And as part of that, I helped to create an adventure-based wilderness program. And the Allagash was our springboard. That's where I ended up taking hundreds of young people, underprivileged, up there for adventures. And so I was able to continue to to be up there and be a part of it. And I never really thought that, I'd be working on the Allagash, but after a couple of layoffs and not knowing what I was going to do in my mid-40s, a little hope for all you people out there who have a dream job. But anyway, I ended up applying for an assistant park ranger position and was fortunate enough to get that. And 13 years later, here I am as superintendent. So it was a roundabout path, but I ended up finally having the dream job. And it's really been the honor of my professional life to be a part of the Allagash Wilderness Waterway in this way and work with some tremendous rangers and so many other partners in that part of the world, the foundation and all the private landowners. It's really a dream come true.
Well, tell us about that. Tell us about what needs to be done to manage a wilderness. On the one hand, you have to leave it alone, but on the other hand, as you said, you have to work with people. Tell us about a season for you, a high season for you.
Right now we're in the thick of getting ready for, you know, our busy season, which is our canoe season. And so it really starts with, you know, our staff and making sure that they're well-trained. We've expanded our training recently to, it's actually a 9-day training over the course of a month, because we have a lot of seasonal folks that join us on the team. And so they need to be very aware of our specific rules and regulations and all the things that we need to do to protect not only the people that come and are visitors to the waterway, but also to make sure we're protecting the resource, to make sure that they're following rules and doing all the things they need to. And so they need to be trained up, making sure that we really put our focus on those kinds of things. So that's certainly part of it. And then, the wilderness character is at the core of our mission, making sure that we're doing what we can to keep things exactly the way that they are. You know, I ask a lot of people when they come up, a lot of our rangers do, if people are having a good visit and if there's anything we can do better. And the response is overwhelmingly, don't do anything, leave it just the way it is. And so we hear that loud and clear. And that's what we really try to make sure happens. And actually in the last couple of years, 2 years ago, we had a representative from the Northern Forest Canoe Trail come and we did an assessment and inventory of all of our campsites, because we wanted to look forward, you know, in terms of what we could do to make sure that we're maintaining our sites and what could we do for wilderness enhancements along the shoreline. And so with that, we spent almost a whole summer with that individual. And then last year we had the Northern Forest Canoe Trail actually come up and spend a summer. It was a 5-person crew. And we focused initially on Churchill Lake, on Schofield Point, which is a campsite, and Schofield Cove, which is another campsite. And there was black fabric from previous work that had been done to keep the erosion under control. And so we removed all of that, and we did a lot of wilderness enhancements along the shoreline and between what we call campsite cells. It might be a campsite, but we have multiple cells that people can stay at, each with their own picnic table and fire pit. And so last year we started that. And again, it was really about making sure that we were doing what we could on the shoreline to create, you know, a better buffer so that, you know, if you were floating by, you'd be able to see a sign and know there was a campsite, but you'd have to really look. Mm. And so that's a big part of what we've been doing. And now we've got another crew. We're working with the Maine Conservation Corps and the Northern Forest Canoe Trail again to have them come up this year to continue that. And you know, there's a lot of other things that go into making sure that we're paying attention to the wilderness character. You know, I work with all of the different private landowners. We have what we call a restricted zone. And I'm sorry, I wasn't listening earlier, so I don't know how much of this has already been discussed. But
no, this is really good. Yeah. I'm so glad you said this, Mark, because I understand about, is it 500 feet on either side of the river is completely protected, but then there's the restricted zone. Explain what that means.
Yeah, so there's three zones, and it's really from the high water mark, it's 400 to 800 feet on either side of the river or the body of water. So we've got this 92-mile corridor, and so 400 to 800 feet, it does vary. And that's what we have jurisdiction over. That's what we have control over, what we focus on in terms of enforcement and things of that nature. So that's the restricted zone. And then beyond that is what we call the quarter-mile zone. And that's really about if people want to do any development at all, if they want to put a road or a bridge. And this would be for private landowners. So we have a number of private landowners, and including public lands that buffer, that come right up against the restricted zone. And so I work with those different people to make sure that if they're going to be doing a harvest, that we know what kinds of roads or any development that would be going on within that quarter mile. And we do that. They have to work with us through a notification process if they're going to do any timber harvesting all the way out to 1 mile. So that's the 1 mile zone. So we got the restricted zone, quarter mile zone, and then the 1 mile zone. So again, that body, that ribbon of water that is our water trail all the way up to from Telos Dam all the way to East Twin Brook Rapids, we have to monitor that. And the landowners have, with my experience, have been fantastic in working with us and wanting to make sure that they're doing everything that they're supposed to be doing.
Mark,
and we also have, go ahead.
I just wanted to get a sense of how many, you know, you said you're coming up on your busy season, and I have a feeling that that's one of those words that's different for different areas. It's probably not the same as the busy season on Sebago Lake. How many people are you going to be expecting this summer in the Allagash Wilderness Waterway?
That's a really great point, Jennifer, because the number I'm going to give you isn't going to sound very busy compared to a Sebago Lake or a Popham Beach or Reed or a number of other parks in more in busier locations. So our busy season, the canoe season, where we have rangers spread out in ranger stations from, again, Chamberlain Bridge all the way up to Mishu Farm, we'll probably have this year, it's been fairly consistent between 4,500 to 5,500 paddlers. So that doesn't sound like many, but, you know, over really it's June, July, August, and then things start to taper. But in those months, that's what we're looking at.
And yeah, and those are, that's 4,500 to 5,500. Yeah, 4,500 to 5,500 people having experience of a lifetime, probably something that they've planned for years and gotten the time off work. And I really appreciate you calling in. Mark DeRoche with the Bureau of Parks and Lands and also Superintendent of the Allagash Wilderness Waterway. And Janet, I want to turn to you because some of what Mark was talking about, isn't it the same idea that you're talking about in terms of protecting the forest? When we're talking about this restricted area and looking at the lands that are not adjacent to but near the Allagash Wilderness Waterway, we're learning a lot about the filtering that forests do and how important they are to the entire ecosystem, right?
Yeah, well, first I just wanted to thank Mark and everybody. When I was up there, they were so incredibly helpful. I mean, he even delivered cookies to me at Lost Brook when we were working up there, but just the most wonderful and competent staff. So thanks, Mark. But in terms of forests, you know, the forest management has changed a lot in Northern Maine as equipment has changed. And the forest is so much younger than it used to be, simplified, more homogeneous. And, you know, the impacts are not really clear yet on water quality and temperature. We do know that, you know, only 3% of the forest in the watershed is in a late successional older forest condition that has all the forest layers you'd normally see. And there's entire layers missing now when I do field work.
Only 3%. Wow.
Yeah, numbers like that are true for most of Northern Maine, actually. But, you know, forest practices have changed to younger trees. Rotations are short. So the implications of that for biodiversity and how well species manage things like climate change are big. So, you know, managing within the 1 mile zone and what BPL is doing there is obviously really important, but that's why the foundation has been emphasizing the watershed as a whole, because you really can't maintain the water quality and quantity, temperature in the Allagash and all the species there without thinking about the watershed as a whole. So we did spend a fair bit of time thinking about that and are communicating, the foundation is, with landowners about that now.
Paul, you wanted to jump in as well, right?
Well, just to reemphasize the importance of the forest on water temperature, all of those streams, I mean, the lifeblood of the waterway itself is the really almost 1,000 miles or more than 1,000 miles of streams that feed into it. And the forest, through shading and protecting the riverbanks, minimizing sedimentation, definitely contribute to the health and welfare of the fish species, both within the watershed and within the waterway.
I have an email here from, you know what, I actually think he's calling in as well. I'm going to go to Roland calling from Topsom. Hi, Roland, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I live in Topsom, but I grew up in Fort Kent and spent a lot of time over the years in the Allegash. And I was curious about, I think it was Mark, the superintendent's comments about the restricted areas in terms of forestry practices. It seems, I go up there every year to do some hunting, and it seems like even though those rules are in place, they're either not adhered to, or the paper companies find it cheaper to just cut right down to the river and then pay the fines. And I'm wondering if somebody would kind of confirm that happens a lot, because the Allegash isn't what it used to be when I was growing up, and I'd just be curious as to that perspective.
Yeah, Janet, go ahead.
I would say there isn't any cutting in the restricted zone itself, but right up to the restricted zone, there's certainly cutting. And that does have implications, especially the forested wetlands and older stands. But within the 1 mile zone, there certainly is harvesting. And I think in general, there's compliance. I know when I did field work there, I did not see cutting in the restricted zone. I haven't so far. Hopefully, like the budworm epidemic won't lead to that. There's some complicating factors here. But no, I think they're pretty good about maintaining the restricted zone. It's just that it's pretty narrow.
That's been my experience up there over the years, too. The surrounding landowners definitely respect the restricted zone and communicate regularly with the waterway about their intentions in the watershed.
Now, I'll just say one other thing. Half of the restricted zone is wetland, you know, marshes, bogs, sedge meadows. More than half of the waterway is actually water. Only about 20,000 acres of the restricted zone is land. So it's a narrow ribbon, you know, and I feel like that's where we have to think about management differently, because I don't think we can protect it by just focusing on that ribbon.
Roland, thanks so much for calling in. I think we can fit in one more call. We'll go to Fred, who's calling from Arousic. Hi, Fred, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, my question is, what's the best age range for young adolescents to take a trip, and do you have any recommendations for a camp that would be appropriate?
Great question. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, I think that the age range that we found, introduce it to kids who are in the middle school age range, seventh and eighth grade. We feel like that's when the wonder hits. And so you get them in the wonder and you teach them those really basic river and paddling skills, camping skills. But then the high school age range is a terrific age range. So I think introducing kids to the Allegash in middle school is a terrific way to go. But we always encourage family trips and take them up when they're younger, especially if they have their parents with them. Really teach the wonder of the Allegash early.
There you go, Fred. And an email here from Kim. As a young child, I grew up in Florida and was able to participate in a fifth grade program called Nature's Classroom, where we spent a week learning about rivers and creatures that shared the wilderness there. So I was thrilled to hear about a program to take children into the Allegash wilderness. What was heartbreaking to me when I got older was returning to those places in Florida that are now overdeveloped with housing, knowing what was there before and how much it affected the health of the rivers. Seeing some of the recent development in Maine, I fear the same could happen here, so I applaud everyone working to protect the wild parts of the state as much as possible to keep the ecosystem intact. So thank you for that email, Kim. And that will be our last comment for the hour. I appreciate all of you being here today. You heard from Janet McMahon, who is an ecologist and author of A River in Space and Time, and also co-author of this new lovely little book, This Extraordinary Place. Also with us, Daniel Dinsmore with the Allegash Wilderness Waterway Foundation, and Paul Johnson, fisheries biologist with lots of experience on the Allegash Wilderness Waterway. Today's sound engineer, Jane Donahue. Maine Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.